The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Hello and welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm here with Guy Giuffredi to talk about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. Hard to believe, but we've already reached episode 60, a bit of a milestone today. We're recording on Wednesday, August 27th at 9 p.m. This episode is brought to you by our sponsors Omnium and Upscaler.ch. Guy, what's on the agenda tonight?
Quite a bit. In the news, we'll cover robotic donor deliveries, Klarna's upcoming IPO, and the emergence of a new share class called Founder Preferred Stock. In the deep dive, we'll discuss a study by Professor Jay Ritter on US IPOs from the 1990s to today and how companies' appetite for going public has changed. We'll also talk about Future Kitchen's current crowdfunding round with founder Dominic Stroily joining us as a guest. And finally, we'll close out with a quick run through of the financing rounds of the week.
Let's start with the news. In Zurich, Oerlikon, the future is being tested and it smells like doner kebab. ETH spin-off River, together with delivery platform Just Eat, has rolled out Europe's first autonomous delivery robot. It's a small robotic dog on wheels and legs that brings orders from Zaki's World restaurant straight to customers. It can travel up to 15 kilometers per hour, uses AI to detect obstacles, and can even climb curbs and stairs. Right now, it's still accompanied by safety staff. But later, it's meant to be controlled entirely from a remote center. For Just Eat, it's a big step. The first on-demand delivery company in Europe to put robots into street trials. And if it works, it could quickly expand to other cities, maybe even supermarkets or convenience stores. The big question is, will delivery robots really shape our cityscapes in the future? Or is this just a flashy PR stunt for tech-driven pilot projects? Guy, what's your take? We once supported a similar project. Maybe you can give us some perspective.
Well, first of all, let's hope this robodog doesn't bite anyone and behaves on the streets. But yes, of course, this first delivery is partly a PR stunt. Still, it's not to be underestimated. With new technologies, you need to show what's possible. These pilots generate an enormous amount of learning. Does the tech work? What adaptations are needed? What's the right user interface? And is this even the right use case for robots? You find out a lot, not only technically, but also economically. Can this be monetized? At what price point do robots have to land for the model to work? Those are critical questions. And so, yes, this is PR heavy, but through many such pilots, those questions will get answered. And if they're answered positively, I'm convinced robots will find their way into everyday life, whether it's delivery or maybe restaurant service or completely different applications. And let's not forget the cultural shift. Society will need to learn, how do we interact with robots on sidewalks or in traffic the same way we once adjusted to bikes or scooters cutting in front of cars?
Exactly. And in VC, we always ask, is this just hype or is there a real sustainable business model behind it? Personally, I'm usually skeptical of models that depend heavily on regulation or conditions that don't yet exist. They often take a very long time. But in this case, I think the potential benefits are real. I don't see many red flags, and I think we should watch the development closely. Is it a winner-takes-all market? Probably not. But the big players will likely dominate. Still, what happened in Zurich Oerlikon is an exciting milestone. Oh, and Guy, I think you wanted to add something about River.
Yes, good point. River, the startup behind this, we actually covered their last financing round back in season 2. At the time, they were still called Swiss Mile Robotics. And one fun fact, Jeff Bezos invested in that round. They raised around 20 to 25 million at a valuation in the low hundreds of millions. So clearly, serious money and big names are backing this.
So attractive for the startup? Or for the investors?
Definitely attractive for the startup. I think the valuation was around the 100 million mark.
Got it. Let's move from Zurich to Sweden. Klarna is finally making its long-awaited debut on the US stock market this September, but at a much leaner valuation. Back in 2021, Klarna was valued at $50 billion. Now they're aiming for no more than $14 billion. At the IPO, they plan to raise about $1 billion to compete in the crowded buy now, pay later market against giants like Apple Pay and PayPal. Founded in 2005, Klarna today has over 111 million active customers, up 31% year over year. Revenues in Q2 climbed 20% to $823 million. Profits are still slim, around $30 million. But the company insists it's on the right trajectory. Why does this matter? Because Klarna's IPO is seen as a bellwether for the entire European fintech scene. If one of the continent's biggest players goes public at just a fraction of its former valuation, it shows how much the mood in the sector has shifted, away from growth at any cost and toward profitability. So, Guy, is Klarna's valuation drop a warning sign for European startups or simply a healthy reality check after the boom years?
I'd say it's both. On the one hand, yes, it's a warning. Investors are definitely more cautious with European tech right now. Even a giant like Klarna couldn't regain its sky-high valuation. On the other hand, $14 billion is still massive. Remember, just last year, Klarna was trading at under $10 billion after peaking above $50 billion, so this IPO will be closely watched. If it goes well, it could open the door for other European IPO candidates. If not, it could spook the market and force startups to lower their expectations dramatically. Either way, it signals that the zero-interest boom years are over. Capital markets now demand a clear path to profitability.
I see it more positively. Honestly, it's healthy. Valuations are less inflated, and post-IPO stock performance should be more stable. That's good for the market overall. And again, $14 billion is nothing to sneeze at. It's just more realistic compared to the overheated $50 billion figure from 2021. So, personally, I'm optimistic and looking forward to seeing how the IPO plays out. Now, let's move to something from the legal corner. There's a very interesting trend emerging in startup financing. More and more companies, not yet in Switzerland, but possibly soon, are adopting a new share class for founders called Founder Preferred Stock. According to data from The Information and Omnium, about 11% of US startups that raised VC money in the first half of 2025 introduced this share class, nearly double the share 2 years ago. So what's the idea? These shares behave like regular founder common shares, but can be converted into preferred shares at the time of an exit. For founders, this means they can sell more easily, sometimes with tax advantages, and without some of the downsides that employee stock options carry. Critics, though, warn that it can send the wrong signal, that founders are too eager to take money off the table. And in an exit waterfall, conversion of founder common into preferred could push employees and other common shareholders even further back in line. So here's the core question. Is it a good sign if founders secure early liquidity for themselves, or does it undermine trust among investors and employees?
It really depends. Are founder preferred shares introduced early on or only right before an exit, so the founder is guaranteed to benefit? But coming back to your core question, is it good or bad if founders get liquidity early? There are pros and cons. Many VCs will say, no way, founders shouldn't sell early. They see it as a sign the founders aren't fully committed or that they need cash and won't keep investing their energy. For some investors, secondaries are a no-go, but personally, I'm more positive about it. If founders sell a small portion, whether as preferred or common stock, and take some liquidity, they're also taking some risk off the table. That can make it easier for them to take tough decisions because their entire life isn't tied 100% to the startup anymore. It gives them some security and can actually motivate them to stick with it longer rather than thinking, another 5 years with a low salary, scraping by. So in that sense, I think it can be healthy. In practice, founder preferred stock tends to appear later. We've seen it in the US and the UK, but in Switzerland, I've honestly never come across a startup implementing it.
Exactly. So there are really two separate questions here. First, should founders take some money off the table? My answer is also yes. I think it's absolutely fine if in every round, founders sell about 5% of their holdings. And just to be clear, I mean 5% relative, not absolute. So if a founder owns 40%, then they sell 5% of that stake, not 5 percentage points. That's actually quite modest. Doing so also makes salary discussions easier. You can keep founder salaries lower for longer, which is often critical for managing cash burn. Second, I see founder preferred stock as an elegant way to counteract dilution. For example, you could structure it so that a portion of founder common shares can convert into preferred shares when certain milestones are achieved, say revenue or valuation targets. Why? Because I've seen many cases where founders did an outstanding job and were absolutely critical to an exit. But because things took longer or there were pivots, by the end they held only a tiny fraction of equity. And when the liquidation waterfall of preferred shares kicked in, they walked away with almost nothing. That happens more often than people realize. It's just rarely public because shareholder agreements aren't disclosed. And so this kind of structure can give founders some protection against being completely washed out. On the tax side, I'm not entirely sure how it would be treated in Switzerland. Likely, it would be fully taxed since, in effect, it's a bonus. But conceptually, I think it's a very smart approach. I hadn't really heard it framed this way before, and I find it very interesting. There's a US law firm, Fenwick & West, that's leading on this topic. I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing it in Switzerland before too long.
And maybe it could even be a cure for a kind of Swiss disease. Early tech exits. Often, the opportunity cost of continuing is seen as too high, so founders sell for, say, 15 million and walk away. If structures like this gave them stronger incentives to keep going, it might actually encourage bigger, later exits.
With Omnium, you can close your financing round faster and more successfully. Omnium is our partner, an innovative platform for growth financing. It's a true one-stop shop, offering a fully digital, lean, and cost-efficient process, including legal framework, investor KYC, and payment handling. With Omnium, you can choose between three options: a private round using only the platform, a private round plus with access to 10,000 registered investors, or a public round for maximum reach and visibility. However you choose, Omnium helps you close your round faster and more successfully. Want to scale your startup quickly and sustainably? Then the Upscaler program is right for you. It gives you access to a large pool of founders, entrepreneurs, and the right investors. More than 50 startups have already benefited from over 500 workshops, scaling their business nationally and internationally. Learn more at www.upscaler.ch.
Now let's turn to today's deep dive. Looking across the Atlantic at the US tech scene, you see a fascinating paradox. In private markets, there's a frenzy around AI. VCs are chasing every AI story, valuations are soaring, and even half-baked business models without proof of concept are getting funded. But in the public markets, it's a very different picture. Investors are skeptical. Giants like Nvidia and Palantir have seen steep share price declines in recent weeks. Everyone's waiting on two big things: the Fed's interest rate decision and Nvidia's earnings report. Both will heavily influence tech valuations. To really understand this tension, it's worth looking at the data collected by Jay Ritter, a professor at the University of Florida. He's been compiling IPO statistics for decades, building what's probably the most comprehensive database of US IPOs. His data lets us compare the evolution of tech IPOs across different decades and generations.
Yes, Ritter's work is incredibly interesting. I highly recommend it to anyone into these topics. He identifies four major IPO waves: the pre-dot-com years, 1990 to 1998, the dot-com bubble, 1999 to 2000, the Web 2.0 era, 2001 to 2011, and finally, the new web generation from 2012 to 2023. And even a quick look at the numbers shows the difference. In the 1990s, more than 1,200 tech companies went public at an average age of just 8 years. In the past decade, it was only about 485 companies, and on average, they were 11 years old by the time of their IPO. Private company valuations have also skyrocketed. Firms like SpaceX and OpenAI are now worth hundreds of billions privately, something you just didn't see back then.
The reason is obvious. There's so much VC capital available now that companies can stay private much longer. An IPO is no longer a necessity to raise money. It's a strategic choice. And the scale has shifted dramatically. The new web companies had, on average, $200 million in revenue in the year before IPO, four times more inflation-adjusted than companies in the 1990s. But here's the catch. Back then, about 60% of companies were already profitable at IPO. Today, it's only about 24%. Bigger, older, but much less profitable.
And here's the surprising part. Despite those bigger losses, the market has rewarded the newer companies. Ritter calculated that new web IPOs 2012 to 2023 outperformed the broader market by 52 percentage points in the first 5 years after listing. The pre-dot-com IPOs of the 1990s outperformed by 41 points, but the web 2.0 generation of the 2000s, they only beat the market by 15 points. And profitability? Strangely, it hasn't mattered much. The market hasn't really differentiated between black ink and red ink.
And this leads to a paradox. The risks are objectively higher, failure rates of over 10% in the first 3 years after an IPO, yet investors still push valuations upward. They reward novelty, future potential, and scale much more than quality and stability. So what's the consequence? We debated this a lot in preparation for today. You could say solid, stable companies often prefer to stay private, while riskier players head to the public markets. Over time, that can lead to adverse selection, public markets becoming riskier while private markets remain overheated. That's the tension we want to dig into further and ask, what does it mean for us as investors? Let's look at the IPO market, Guy. In the past, many more tech firms went public young and profitable. Today, they're older and often still loss-making. Why such a shift?
In my view, the reason is us, the VCs. Back in the 1990s, there were already some famous VC names, but the industry was much smaller. Funds were smaller. Venture capital was still niche. From the successes of the 90s, the industry grew rapidly. Back then, companies had to go public early if they wanted to raise hundreds of millions. Today, strong companies can raise billions in private rounds, sometimes at higher valuations than they'd get in an IPO, where public investors give them a reality check. And IPOs themselves have become more complex, regulation is stricter, reporting requirements are heavier, and post-IPO companies lose flexibility. So compared to private funding, going public is less attractive than it used to be.
So you'd say VC has effectively replaced the stock market?
Yes, I think that's fair. Venture capital, growth equity, private equity, even sovereign wealth funds, they all provide plenty of capital. Companies like Stripe, Databricks, OpenAI, SpaceX, they can raise $10 billion in private rounds without ever doing an IPO. So an IPO today is optional, not essential for growth. What's fascinating, though, is Ritter's data showing that the loss-making IPOs actually perform better. Max, how do you reconcile that?
It is fascinating. You'd think profitability matters, but investors are laser-focused on growth. Losses don't matter as long as revenue is skyrocketing. That's why the big loss-making IPOs often perform better. It's not rational, it's speculation. Investors hope they've found the next Amazon or Nvidia. But what's interesting is how expectations change after the IPO. Suddenly, the focus shifts to profitability. That paradigm shift is massive. Pre-IPO, everyone only looks at top-line growth. Post-IPO, bottom-line profits suddenly matter. We've seen this recently with companies like CoreWeave. The moment you're public, the spotlight is on earnings. The question is, how long can this last when nobody distinguishes between profitable and unprofitable companies? At some point, Guy, does the bubble burst?
The risk of a crash is definitely there. When liquidity tightens, interest rates rise, and less capital flows into the market, that's when investors refocus on profitability. We saw a glimpse of it in 2022 when almost all tech stocks collapsed. Their valuations were based heavily on future pricing, and when sentiment turned, it all came down. Klarna dropped from $50 billion to $6 to $7 billion. Netflix crashed. DocuSign, Microsoft, everyone got hit. Right now, AI hype is holding valuations up, sometimes at extreme levels. But long term, companies have to deliver fundamentals. Otherwise, the party won't last forever. And yes, the risk of adverse selection is real. The best companies might stay private, while only the riskier ones go public because they can't raise the same money privately.
I see that risk too. Solid companies say, we'll stay private. We can raise enough capital anyway, and with less pressure. That leaves the IPO market with riskier bets, which lowers the overall quality. For us as investors, this means access to private rounds becomes even more important, but also harder. And in public markets, you need to be twice as careful because distinguishing between risk and quality is getting harder. All right, this week we're highlighting another campaign from our partner Omnium. Omnium is the Swiss investment platform where startups can launch fundraising campaigns. Some companies have already raised over $1 million through the platform, which is impressive. On the other side, retail investors can participate easily with relatively small tickets. One of the current campaigns is Future Kitchens, a Swiss food tech platform focused on delivery-first gastronomy. Founded in Zurich in December 2022, they operate both ghost kitchens, kitchens without customer seating, and a network of virtual brands sold exclusively via delivery apps like Uber Eats. Quick disclaimer before we dive in, I'm personally an investor in Future Kitchens and also serve on the board. With us today is the founder and CEO, Dominic Stroily. Great to have you here, Dominic.
Thanks, Max. I'm excited to be here and talk about Future Kitchens.
Let's start simple. What's the core idea behind Future Kitchens? Why does Switzerland need a house of brands for food delivery?
Happy to explain. In a world where people can order anything in two clicks, they want radically better food delivery experiences. With Future Kitchens, we build and operate delivery-only restaurant brands designed specifically for that purpose. We looked at the most ordered online categories, no surprise, pizza, kebab, smash burgers, chicken, Indian. Then we created brands and menus tailored for those categories. We run them in a hybrid model, our own ghost kitchens in cities, and partnerships with local restaurants in smaller towns who have extra capacity.
That sounds exciting. But how does Future Kitchens differ from traditional restaurants or other ghost kitchen operators?
Traditional restaurants focus on dine-in customers. We focus entirely on delivery. That means we design products specifically to arrive in top condition. Our focus is brand and quality. We develop strong restaurant brands with identity, recipes, and quality standards. We even have a 2-star chef designing our menus. Customers notice the difference. Our monthly reorder rates are 25 to 30%, which is above average in delivery.
And you've already built catchy brands like Smash Club or Studio Kebab. What criteria do you use when developing these food brands?
We're very data-driven. We analyze which categories perform best online and build brands that can become the number one in those niches long-term. We also focus on products that travel well and can be consistently produced.
From an investor perspective, how big is the delivery-first gastronomy market in Switzerland, and how fast is it growing?
It's actually very large. I estimate around 2.4 to 2.5 billion Swiss francs, depending on the report. Growth is 5 to 10% annually. It's a strong growth market, and I believe delivery will only become more important. People will cook less at home in the future.
The challenge, of course, is profitability. Delivery businesses often struggle with margins. We've seen this with quick commerce players like Stash. You're growing rapidly, but you're already profitable. How?
Our model is extremely asset light. We can open new delivery locations with partners in just 10 days at a cost of maybe 2,000 to 3,000 Swiss francs. Payback is just a few weeks. That's our secret sauce, asset light operations and low fixed costs.
And since you're operating more than 70 virtual restaurants already, what operational challenges come with that kind of scale?
The name of the game is quality assurance and growth that doesn't come at the expense of quality. From the very beginning, that's been central for us. We don't want to grow at any cost. We want to grow while keeping standards consistent. That's why we invest heavily in products, processes, standardization, and training. That's our biggest challenge today.
And you're already close to profitability. Now you're raising a financing round. Where exactly will this new capital go?
The capital will mainly go into building our teams, marketing, sales, account management, onboarding, and product development. We want to strengthen those functions so we can grow faster and better.
Why did you decide to raise this round via Omnium, and how has the experience been so far?
Right now, we're in the pre-sale phase where investors can register early and get preferential conditions. We chose a crowd investing campaign because we wanted to involve our customers directly to build stronger ties and community. The campaign has started really well, strong interest, many signups, and we're excited for the official launch.
Looking ahead, how important will investors be for scaling the model? And what's the unique selling point that convinces them? Many similar concepts are struggling to raise even a franc, yet you've managed to attract significant funding quickly. What's your edge?
I think what resonates with investors is our traction. In a short time, we've already hit millions in revenue with a small team and very little external capital. We bootstrapped for a long time, and yet our unit economics already make sense today, not only in the future. As for investors, this round and previous ones brought in smart money, people who've done it before, who can advise us, support us strategically, and guide us in the right direction. That was very important for me.
Earlier, you explained how you create new food brands. Can you walk us through the process in more detail? From the initial idea to the launch of a virtual brand?
Sure. It starts with market research. We look at trends in the US, in Europe, in big food capitals. What's hot there? Then our development team, led by Laurent Eperon, begins working on recipes and tests. We usually run 2 to 4 test cycles, scoring them across various factors before taking them into our future kitchens lab in Zurich. We always test recipes and brands internally first. If results are positive, we scale them to partner restaurants. Standardization is key. Our meat, bread, fried chicken, sauces, desserts, fries, everything is consistent across locations. That ensures quality and scalability.
Speaking of scalability, will Future Kitchens remain a Swiss player, or is the model designed for international expansion?
Definitely international. Burgers and pizza are eaten worldwide, delivery is unstoppable, and I believe our model works abroad as well. We're preparing for it now. 2026 will be our year.
Very exciting. And one slightly critical question. If you could only keep one of your brands, which would it be and why?
It would have to be Smash Club, both financially and emotionally. It was our first brand, still our biggest driver today, and I remember those early days vividly. I created the recipes at home with my brother, who's a chef, and I personally grilled the first 10,000 burgers. So yes, definitely Smash Club.
Great story. Nostalgia wins over economics here. We wish you all the best for the campaign and for scaling up in 2025 and 2026.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Let's move on to this week's deals of the week. We'll briefly cover the financing rounds and exits announced since our last episode.
This week, about 28 million Swiss francs were raised across 5 startup funding rounds in Switzerland, and unfortunately, no exits.
Starting with the biggest deal, Loft Dynamics in Zurich raised $24 million in a Series B.
The ETH spin-off builds the world's only FAA and ESA-certified VR helicopter simulator. Customers already include Airbus Helicopters, the LA Police Department, and Air Greenland.
Now Loft Dynamics is entering airline pilot training with smaller, cheaper VR simulators for Boeing and Airbus.
The round was led by Friedkin, Alaska Airlines, Kraft Ventures, Sky Dayton, and UP Partners. With this Series B, Loft Dynamics has now raised over $60 million, aiming to improve pilot training safety worldwide.
From Zurich to Geneva, Flybox closed a pre-seed round of just under 3 million Swiss francs.
Flybox, founded by serial entrepreneur Alain Debeau, is developing flying hydrofoil platforms to transport containers across water, silently, without waves, and without emissions.
Prototypes have already been tested on Lake Geneva, with interest from brands like Moët Hennessy, Evian, and L'Oréal, as well as destinations like Bahrain.
The funding will go toward proof of concept and additional tests in Geneva and Dubai.
In Schlieren, Baxiva secured $3 million from the nonprofit CARBX.
They're developing multivalent glycoconjugate vaccines against dangerous E. coli infections that cause UTIs and sepsis, both strongly linked to antibiotic resistance.
The funding supports further development of their serotype-specific vaccine platform.
And with CARBX backing, Baxiva moves one step closer to clinical trials.
Next up, Zug-based Previse Systems received a minority investment from Lightrock.
Founded in 2019, Previse develops a cloud-native energy trading and risk management platform already used by more than 20 leading energy companies.
With Lightrock's capital, Previse will accelerate product development, expand internationally, and meet rising energy market demand.
Exactly. In times of volatile prices, renewable uncertainty, and massive intraday trading, this solution really hits a nerve. Lightrock's network should help them take the next step.
And from Zurich, Zenline.ai raised 1.6 million Swiss francs in a pre-seed round.
They develop AI agents for assortment decisions in European retail, over a million products analyzed so far.
Investors include Seedcamp, Yellow, First Momentum Ventures, and ARC Investors.
The funds will accelerate product development, expand into new retail segments, and help merchants compete with Amazon and Temu.
Finally, in Lausanne, the FIT Foundation awarded 4 100,000 Swiss franc tech grants.
Recipients include Hevelion, a Yunal Chuv project building a spatial omics biomarker platform, and 3 EPFL spin-offs.
One is Kymansis, developing a wearable for cardiovascular monitoring with clinical accuracy.
Another is Iris, using AI and imaging to accelerate biologics development.
And Ronexum, improving cryoelectronics for quantum computers, up to 90% more efficient.
4 exciting projects now supported by FIT, helping them take the next steps toward market readiness.
That's it for this week's Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you'd like to support us, subscribe to our newsletter and share it with your network. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great weekend. Take care and bye for now.